And at that point, I think I must have been terrified. I have no comment to make about what Murray First Radio is now, I'm afraid. I hit the buffers, I'd overdone it. I was off work for 6 months.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Thomas Prague.
Young Thomas was a spoilt little brat. He was the third child of two German parents who had met in England pre-war. They were refugees. Grew up in Dulwich. My father was a teacher and spent all of his career after the war teaching in Westminster School because he didn't need British teaching qualifications to teach at a public school. They just looked at the individual. And he chose that school because his three sons could go there. And so that accounts for my accent. But I was spoilt. I was lazy. I scraped through things, always. So I failed my 11 plus, much to my parents' distress, I'm quite sure. I failed the entrance exam to Westminster School the first time, but they let me take it again, and I got through with flying colours. So if I needed to, I could. And that's the story of my life, really. I don't think I had any idea of a future career or anything of that sort. We were, of course, radio listeners in those days. So, you know, all the classic stuff, the light programme, the BBC comedies. The third programme played a big part in our house because my parents liked music and so on. I had an old-style crystal radio set that you had to actually get the crystal to work. You know, you had to scrape around till it worked. And I had an old Mallard radio, and I'm just mentioning that because I had a good loudspeaker. That was quite a decent radio. I think it had been my aunt's. And I listened to Movie Go Round. I can still sing the theme tune from Carousel, I think. Da 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 da. And it was great. And I very rarely went to the cinema, but it told terrific stories. And I do remember thinking, actually, you know, I could be a film critic. I was privileged. I was very lucky. My poor brothers had to work hard, and I just got away with it. Did I think about radio? No. I'm not one of those people who went into radio because it was a big passion. I leave school and scraped into a university and into Oxford. Unbelievably, when you look back. Nowadays, I wouldn't have stood a chance. What I did was showed that I could use my brain. Philosophy, politics and economics as a degree, but actually spent most of my time doing other things, which was really what Oxford was about. So, I got involved in OUDS, the University Dramatic Society, really a semi-professional repertory company, and became president of the Oxford University Opera Club. I don't like opera very much, but what they needed was a manager. Fairly importantly, I also met a young lady there who's still with me, Angela. We met backstage doing The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, which most people have never heard of. It's by Brecht and Weil, and it's a lovely story. But what to do? Yes, I applied to the Rank organisation, the lady who ran the Playhouse Theatre in Oxford. She tried to get me to take on an Arts Council administrator's traineeship, and the BBC was the next logical thing to apply for. I then applied to them for something called a Programme Operations Assistant, in anybody else's language, studio manager. And that took me into broadcasting and into radio. We were based in the Langham, which is a very grand building just opposite Broadcasting House, and was BBC. They'd taken it over after the war and used it for all kinds of things. Now a very grand hotel. I do remember leaning out of a window there because we had to learn how to do commentary. So we had to lean out of a window with a microphone and talk about what was going on in Oxford Street below us. It was a really good grounding. It was a very good way of learning about broadcasting, television or radio. The beauty of radio was it was technically so much simpler. I think we were all pretty defensive of radio. Television, I think, was still seen as slightly weird, pretty clunky. I don't remember many of us actually wanting to work in television. We did get the choice when we graduated of working in Broadcasting House. We'd all done a stint in BH, and I did do Mrs. Dale's Diary, yes.
A recording of the daily happenings in the life of a doctor's wife.
I can't remember whether I did the rattling of the teacups or whatever. We did spot effects and closing doors, opening doors, and rattling the teacups or whatever.
I've been very lazy over the weekend and haven't made a single entry in my diary since Friday.
And I did do Alan Freeman, and it was Pick of the Pops, that's right. So I would be usually the Grams operator or the tape operator.
That's right, that's the third week running for top of Pick of the Pops there at number one, Sega and Evans in the year 25-25. Right, now here we've got this week's Pick of the Pops, top 20.
So in that studio, there would have been a studio manager who would be operating the desk.
Down at number 20, Goodnight Midnight from Clodagh Rogers. Brand new at number 19, I'll Never Fall in Love Again, coming from Bobby Gentry.
The presenter was not self-hopping. He was sitting the other side of the glass. There was a producer, too. There would have been then a Grams operator. And there probably was a tape operator because they would have recorded the whole thing. And, can't forget the secretary, who was writing everything down in a PSB, the program as broadcast, so all the copyright details. This was a big team effort. At Broadcasting House, you would be, as the junior member of the team, introduced to everybody, and you would shake hands at the beginning of the recording session or whatever it was. And then after the show, you'd go up to the canteen maybe, but you would all sit at different tables. Bush House, you probably never got introduced to anybody, but you would have a curry with them at 3 o'clock in the morning and talk about the problems of the world in some language or other. Totally different atmosphere, much more my scene. Yeah, Bush House was fascinating. It was the world service, technically, but it was so there was the English language service which went round the world 24 hours a day, so in different countries at different times. We were all classified voice-wise. We were all put in front of a matronly lady who was in charge of voice classification or something like that. And I was classified as, I think it was A1 or something. In other words, I had Queen's English and I could speak reasonably clearly. So I was allowed to do some of the frequency announcements. So it would have been something like, this is the BBC World Service, broadcasting on so-and-so meters in the medium wave band, and of course it also would have been long wave and short wave. I can't remember them all, but it felt important.
This is London.
But the only other thing I really remember from then is that everybody remembers where they were for the moon landing. I was, I think, the junior member of the team for the Arabic service that night, and so I never heard the words. And this is one small step, because the whole thing was in Arabic. I don't even know what I was doing there, because there wasn't much for anybody to do. They were simply watching a black and white television and describing it in Arabic. And I suppose they must have had the odd expert, perhaps on tape or whatever, and maybe that's what I was there to do, and maybe we played the odd record. But I didn't understand a word of it. It didn't matter. No. Great place to work.
Okay, I just checked.
Yes, I then thought, I quite like this, and they were starting up the second wave of BBC local stations. I applied to get a job as a station assistant at Radio Oxford. I was in at the beginning of Radio Oxford. The BBC had by then decided that this was a good thing. It was actually a terrific thing for the BBC because it was such a good training ground.
And now, I believe I shall become the first Lord Mayor to usurp the role of a disc jockey by playing the record which introduces the next programme.
The very first programme was written by Humphrey Carpenter, and he'd cooked up this kind of drama, and it was to be the Up in a Balloon, I think it was called, and it was about a balloon flight in Oxford, and it was a musical, and it was... I could still sing one of the songs, but I'm not going to. There I was as the desk operator for this fully-fledged drama, and I was allowed to do all of this in a little local radio studio.
This is BBC Radio Oxford, and I am the station manager, Donald Norbrook.
And there were some really good people. Donald Norbrook was the charming old-style BBC manager who knew basically to leave people to get on with it and keep the BBC off our backs. That was his role. I think an awful lot of people in the rest of the BBC were extremely doubtful about local radio because it had lots of amateurs. It had lots of people who... This was the beginning of breaking down the professionalism. The professional elite who thought that you could only do this if you're a very special person with a special voice. And it was a kind of little cabal. And while originally just a station assistant, I then did become producer. I don't know what we were called, producer-presenter. That's effectively what you did. I did a series on church bells.
Whereas you can break a bottle of champagne over the bows of a ship to launch it, our station engineer, Cliff Wright, has given some excellent technical reasons for not cracking a bottle over one of his microphones.
What a chance for a young person wanting to get into broadcasting. I was young, naive, and, if I'm honest, scared shitless of almost everything, because like a lot of young people, you don't really believe you can do it. You're going to be caught out at any minute. Somebody's going to find you out. The BBC was a good employer. It didn't actually think about any individual careers whatsoever. When the situation changes, they're not really thinking about the individuals, or they weren't then. There was no personnel department that worried about that. But they were good at the structural stuff, so attachments, as they call them, secondments, whatever. You could, if you wanted, apply to go and work in other places and do other things. And I did a little bit of that. I did the most boring job I've ever done in my life, which was to be a BBC TV continuity presenter. That was dull. All you did was sit there and wait for something terrible to happen on BBC One or BBC Two. I earned my keep twice. Grandstand was the big afternoon sports programme, an iconic thing. And they did try to do live broadcasts from places, which was, of course, not as reliable. And 30 seconds before Grandstand was due to come from a race course somewhere, I can't remember which one, in my ear somebody says, "Phil, the line's gone down." So they got a very long trailer for Doctor Who, which was coming on later that afternoon, and you did also have a record that you could play music if you really had to. But then in your ear comes the voice that says, "Keep going." And then after a bit, "OK, ready in 10. And then at very short notice, I was asked to go and be the senior producer for an opt-out in Inverness. I think it was called Radio Highland. So I went there. I did ask where Inverness was. So I ended up in Inverness with about a week to go before they went on the air. That was a good example of the BBC giving you that opportunity. They had done some opt-out programming, but it had been done by producing tapes in a sort of makeshift studio, which were then taken out to the local transmitter and played from the transmitter. But they had decided that they would invest in local broadcasting and local radio. And so there were some opt-outs being developed. And this was very much along English local radio's tile, but with very limited airtime. Our breakfast show started out as being 15 minutes opt-out of the Radio Scotland programme. We had the Gaelic Minute. The Gaelic Minute was famous. It was meant to be a bilingual station. Gaelic was very controversial at the time. The BBC was never truly sure that that's what it wanted to do in Scotland and have local stations. I think it's a great shame they didn't, but they didn't. I went back to Radio Oxford and then came back again later full-time as the BBC Highland programme organiser then. If I remember rightly, the real issue was there to be a Radio Scotland, which was effectively an across-the-board radio station. At that time, they opted out Radio 4 and, I think, Radio 2. and there wasn't a full network, and there were Gaelic programmes hived off somewhere else, not many. So it was a bit of a mess. And then I think the idea was to have BBC-style local radio stations broadcasting, if not all the time, a lot of the time. And that's what I went there to do. That was my skill by then. And then they changed their minds. The budgets were removed and the post was not downgraded, but the title changed again and it wasn't going to develop as a local station. I began to look at other things. There was quite a lot of talk about local radio and developing local broadcasting, and commercial broadcasting was started under the authority of the IBA, the Independent Broadcasting Authority. And they had shared this out fairly evenly, and so that there were a same number of independent, they weren't allowed to use the word commercial. This was nasty stuff, had advertising in it. That was very much how it clearly felt to civil servants, that this was fairly nasty stuff. And one of those was going to be for the north of Scotland. And I was at the BBC and thought this was really quite a good idea. But, I mean, it wasn't anything I was thinking of doing. This was not me. My career was clearly in the BBC somewhere in the hierarchy, climbing up the ladder. So they advertised this thing, and a local group, this was for Aberdeen and Inverness, a local group in Inverness got together and said, Aberdeen and Inverness, this is nonsense. And they were right. Culturally and physically, it was nonsense. It's 2.5 hour, 3 hour drive between Inverness and Aberdeen. And there were actually community groups that applied in Aberdeen and in Inverness. The Murray Firth Community Radio Association put in a bid at fairly short notice. And I actually had helped a bit on the programme side. And much to everybody's surprise, including theirs, the IBA gave them the franchise, as it was. And they were thunderstruck, but delighted, and then had to raise the money. The complications of funding this, I wasn't directly involved in, and remember, I was working for the BBC and had no idea of working for them at all. They tried to raise money through a share offering. They were very badly advised by a merchant bank in Scotland. Eventually, they raised the kind of money they needed. They reduced the community radio involvement and Standard Broadcasting. A man called Bob Kennedy flew over the Atlantic from Canada and committed a chunk of money, which then drew in other money from the Daily Record, from Grampian Television, from Macallan Whiskey, thankfully, and people like that, and some small local shareholders, and they raised enough capital. Then they had the problem of finding somebody to actually put this together and make it run. And eventually they came to me and said, would you be programme controller? And I said, no, I don't know enough about pop music, I can't do that. And anyway, you're not paying enough. And a little while later on, my good friend, Sam Marshall, doctor, he would phone me up occasionally, and he phoned up as the mole. He said, well, if you, what about the chief executive, they called it? Would you do that? And I said, the only thing matters is that I get a good pension deal from the BBC. You're going to have to match that. And they gave me the job. And at that point, I think I must have been terrified. I knew nothing about the commercial world. I knew nothing about money. And I certainly didn't know what a risk I was taking. And that was just as well. And it was. On paper, it was disastrous and was not viable. And I think the IBA knew that. They had offered a license to a community group in Cardiff at that time, and that went horribly wrong. It was covering a massive area for a local radio station. I mean, it would take you, the medium wave signal, AM signal, was at night time reaching from Wick in the far north, which is effectively John O'Groats, to Fraserburgh. Fraserburgh is a fishing town at the other end of the Murray Firth. At least a 4 hour car journey, and then was 5 hours because the bridge didn't exist that links. Under 200,000 people, I think, in their patch. and nobody believed really that this was viable. But we had our sales manager who had been part of the bid, Rod Webster, who was one of the people who made this possible. He had added up all the local newspapers and how much money they were taking every week. There were, I think, 20 local newspapers in the area, but they were all taking advertising. He only needed 2% of that revenue or whatever for us to be viable. And the second reason was that there had been nothing for people in this area. This wasn't a community. The Murray Firth community as such didn't exist because they were miles apart. And the third reason we managed to make it work was because we didn't know it shouldn't. We didn't know this was different and unique and shouldn't have worked.
Good morning. It's Tuesday the 23rd of February 1982, and welcome to the very first day of broadcasting from your new independent local radio station. This is Murray Firth Radio on 271 metres, 1107 kilohertz in the medium wave band, and on 95.9 megahertz VHF in stereo.
We went on the air on the 23rd of February at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was a Tuesday. I needed coverage. We couldn't afford any advertising. You know. The TV station, Grampian Television, was going to cover it. We wanted advance coverage. They didn't do anything on a Sunday, so we could get into the Monday night magazine show, and they would give us some coverage. The first thing was a blessing from the minister who had been chairman of the community radio group that had finally got the license. And the first bulletin was read by Isabel Fraser. She was somewhat nervous and had never done radio before. She'd done a little job in the local newspapers, and it was read at 90 miles an hour. You know, she was so nervous.
Good morning, Isabel Fraser with the news headlines at 6:30. Print unions at Times newspapers are meeting this morning to discuss the sacking of 210 clerical staff. Owner Rupert Murdoch ordered the dismissals after the...
Two other memorable things about that. The head of sales, commercial producer, and one or two others had been up all night carting the ads. In those days, adverts and jingles were all played on what some people might remember as 8-track cartridges. They were a loop of tape, so they always went back to the beginning. You didn't have to rewind them. They just went on. That's why they were so useful for that job. But every single ad which had been advert had been made in our second studio, we had two studios, had to be transferred from reel to reel onto an individual cart. They all had to be ready by 7 o'clock in the morning. We thought we were the broadcaster, but we weren't. Technically, the IBA were the broadcaster. So they controlled everything on paper. Building the studios had to be to their specifications. And the first fights we had, which I think the rest of the independent sector in Britain should thank us for, is that we began to persuade the IBA that some of their rules were flipping ridiculous, particularly some of the acoustic standards. Most radio presenters work very close to the microphone, so what on earth does it matter what the rest of the studio sounds like? You're never going to hear it. The IBA wanted us to have two proper studio doors and an airlock for every studio so that you couldn't hear anybody coming in or out and there would be no leakage of sound. We persuaded them that they could just have an ordinary fire door on the outer door, please. It would be much cheaper. The IBA were very friendly. John Thompson, in particular, Paul Brown and Peter Baldwin were the key people. And I think they were all sitting in London just waiting for this to go wrong.
Hello, I'm Dave Cochran. I'll be here every morning, Monday to Friday, for the breakfast show. And it's really great to have you along on Murray Firth Radio. And the message in Barbara Dixon's record really sums it all up for today and for the rest of your life on Murray Firth Radio. Take good care.
There were good friends in independent radio at that time. They all helped each other. It was a club. People running the smaller stations, particularly small by ILR standards, Bob Hussle in Plymouth, Orwell in Ipswich. But they were all kind of wanting us to succeed. We were no competition to anybody, but they kind of liked the idea that it would succeed. All except probably, he was always very friendly, Jimmy Gordon at Clyde, who really had ambitions to even then. His favourite theme for many years was the mother hen and chicks. and he wanted to be the mother hen and we would be the chicks. Not very long after we went on the air, we had the biggest event in the area for some time, which was the Keswick Bridge, hugely important economically, linking the north of Scotland, the Highlands, with Inverness, and shortening the journey. And still, I mean, massively important. The two things that created the Murray Firth were the Keswick Bridge and Murray Firth Radio. They brought the area together. But the opening was to be done by the Queen Mother. Now, the Queen Mother was by then in her 80s and was not thought to have long in this world. So we all wanted to be there to broadcast the last occasion on which she would do something significant, which, of course, was a lot later. But we had no equipment. So that was a challenge, cobbling together. Remember, mobile phones were radio telephones. There were only three frequencies available in the Highlands. We had a line in, put into where the opening was taking place so we'd get the speeches. The rest was done using telephones, ordinary telephones, but they weren't mobile phones, didn't exist. I still treasure a picture, a rather fuzzy picture, of a couple of lawyers, young lawyers. No, one of them was a lawyer, one was a businessman of some sort. And they were leaning out of their top floor window, holding a phone, reporting into the radio station, describing what they could see as the Queen Mother passed below.
And looking out over the bridge, we can see out in the Firth a couple of North Sea oil support vessels who put on a special display of spraying water. These are vessels which are in use for fire prevention on oil rigs. We're driving across the centre span now. We can.
But the main challenge, I suppose, was the commercial one. We had to pay our way. We had loans to pay off. And Rod did that. Rod Webster, he told a wonderful story of going into a garage to sell some advertising. And he used all kinds of techniques. And the guy said, well, how do I know people are listening to Murray Firth Radio? Rod said to him, well, I'm going to go out and we're going to go out and look at all the cars in your second-hand car lot. And we're going to see what the radio stations are tuned to. If more than 50% at Murray for the Radio, or whatever it was, you're going to buy a week, month's worth of advertising. And they shook hands on it and he went out. And of course, the story ends well in that almost all of them had Murray for the Radio tuned on their radios.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Enjoy the show with Murray for the Radio.
And welcome to Radio Furrymouth. Time, ladies and gentlemen, for our super duper phone in golden oldies competition where you can win Tosh's t-shirt. Take it off, Tosh.
There it is. There you are.
Don't rip it.
The audience figures were, of course, yeah, sky high. But it wasn't really surprising in radio terms. In those days, A, there wasn't much any competition. And B, this was a remote area. So if we hadn't got in excess of 50% reach, we didn't often get our audience figures because we couldn't afford them. Very expensive. Actually, the only time when things were getting pretty difficult was, and I can't give you the exact year, but there was a recession towards the end of the 80s, I think. And we had grown a bit by then. You know, we'd been successful enough and we had made money, but not a lot. It was financially quite well managed. Day one, we had good management accounts every month. If there's any other advice financially I ever gave anybody after that was get honest, accurate monthly accounts, management accounts, because that way you know exactly what's happening when it's happening, not 6 months later when it's too late. Remember that radio stations at that time and ownership of them and the funding of them was not unlike football. Particularly in smaller towns. So the same kind of people would often invest, and they weren't investing in Murray Firth Radio to make money. They were investing in Murray Firth Radio because they didn't want to be left out. And it was reasonably clear from day one that they really just wanted me not to lose money and not to go broke. The Community Radio Association that had set it up was still a 20% shareholder, had three directors on the board. So the board was quite big. We had people from the Daily Record, Grampian Television. We had Bob Kennedy from Standard Broadcasting for a while, not for long. My chairman at the time was really just a radio nut, Alistair Gardner. He ran hotels and hospital radio. He wanted to present the Request programme on a Sunday, and he did. A really two-way record requests. You remember the... anybody old enough to remember that extraordinarily old-fashioned programme? Well, ours was a very similar version of that. People loved it. Followed by a Scottish music programme, followed by a country and western, it was called then, country music. Very popular. I also had Willie Phillips. Willie Phillips was the managing director of Macallan Whiskey, was an accountant to trade. The rest of the board, local builder. Very typical board, actually, for commercial radio in those days. I nearly lost my job at one stage because we weren't making money. I think this was probably after the recession when we had made people redundant. We weren't losing money, but we were making money. I'm sure every managing director of a small station has been through that at some stage. It's like a football club. I think a change of the manager will make all the difference. I survived. It was never easy. It was never easy. The thing I remember most, throughout that time, trained I don't know how many hundreds of people. Some of them just because they were volunteers, many who started with us at 10 or 12. Darren Adam is on LBC just now, I think, and he started with us as a, I think he was under 10. Gary Robertson presents the breakfast show on Radio Scotland, young lad with us. So volunteers, but also we ran a training unit of some sort all the time, funded by unemployment projects or whatever. Never our money, we didn't have it. These are people who came to us, ran, latterly became known as the information desk.
Now then, Len is out with the radio car this morning in Forres.
I'm at Lee and Coyle Hospital, just on the edge of Forres. And I'm standing beside Jimmy Innes, who is 100 today. Amazing. We've just opened the telegram from the Queen. Jimmy, how do you feel this morning, now that you're 100? How do you feel?
Eh?
How do you feel this morning? You're 100 today. You're looking very well. Are you keeping fine? That's good. You've just opened your telegram from the Queen. Did you think you would get it? You got the military medal in 1916. Do you remember that? Do you remember getting the military medal in 1916?
The engineer, Donny Aird, who was engineer for many years, and is legendary. He was a classic old-fashioned engineer. Bits of sticky tape and God, goodness knows what. But it was never, no, we can't do that. No, I'll make that work. Somehow I'll make it work. And he always did. To be honest, we were a good radio station. We also learned how to put in the awards. The important thing about the awards was they were so good for morale. And particularly a Station of the Year thing involved everybody. So I always tried to do something with it. So everybody got a gold certificate. 1 year. I think that was the fourth year, third or fourth year we went. I thought, I've got to do something for them all. And that was the year the judges said, I think it was John Inverdale who was chairing that particular one, this is the station we'd all wish we could work for. We felt good about that, yes. There comes a period we had done various things. We had been the first station to get IIP, Investors in People Award. And you can't tell this part of the story without the personal bit, which is that I crashed, basically. I hit the buffers, I'd overdone it. I had no idea that that's what was going on, but I was off work for 6 months and should have been longer. And I'd been doing this too long and taking too much out of me. I can tell you exactly where it got serious was I was one of the judges on a Sony Awards panel. And I flew down to London. I was flying up and down to London a lot because I tended to be on the committee of CRCA, the Commercial Radio Companies Association or whatever it was called, and things like that. It was a way of me plugging into the rest of the industry. So I was up and down quite a lot. I would get involved in things. And I got on the plane, which I was doing regularly to fly back, and I suddenly had the most major panic attack. I just remember thinking, Which is worse, getting off this plane and having to find my way home some other way, or trying to stay on the plane so that I get home where I feel safe? I had no idea what was going on. Since learnt that this is a very common thing. I do remember finding a friend on the plane, which was quite common. This was the Inverness commuter flight, you know, we all knew each other, and drinking several gin and tonics, and then driving home afterwards and getting in touch with my doctor. And it was panic attacks were the real thing. It kind of turned into, as it does with many people, into a depression of sorts. I look back at a picture from that time, so you can see it in my face. And that was with me for on and off for many years after that. And probably still is, but it's managed. Because I was reasonably outgoing and well known, I was able to tell people what was going on. That was not common in the late 90s. You knew that people had what had been called nervous breakdowns, but nobody really talked about it. I was confident enough that it was okay to talk about it a bit. If you have a broken leg, everybody understands it. If you have cancer, everybody is sympathetic and feels terrible about it, as they should. If you have a mental health issue, they're still not sure how to talk to you about it. So while I was ill, and not because I was ill, things began to change. By that time, Scottish Radio Holdings were bigger shareholders. They had bought out somebody else's shareholding. Our company was set up in such a way that the shareholders could only sell to each other unless the other shareholders agreed. So nobody new could buy in without their approval. And it was done that way in order to protect its independence. But it doesn't work if two of the big shareholders get together and one becomes the majority shareholder, which is what happened. So Scottish Radio Holdings became the majority shareholder and then had to buy out the other shareholders. That was fine because I knew Jimmy Gordon, I knew Richard Finlay, who was running it by then. Jimmy, I think, was chair. And they weren't about to take over the programming and so on. But you could see this was going to change. In fact, I was chairman of Murray Firth Radio for a short while within the Scottish Radio Holdings Group. They then became part of EMAP, and EMAP was bought out by Bauer. So now it's owned. I have no comment to make about what Murray Firth Radio is now, I'm afraid. It's a different beast. I have no professional knowledge of what they do because it isn't what I was good at. It's a music station with a bit of local content. Seems to be quite effective in that they still get a good audience and they certainly make money. So who's to argue with that? Perhaps the bit of Murray Firth Radio that shouldn't be forgotten is that it played a huge part in developing community radio generally. To start with, it proved that it could be done. It proved that you could use volunteers and it wasn't the end of the world. We began to develop community groups around the area. So there are now community stations of one sort or another in places like Ullapool, Stornoway, Skye, Caithness. All of these were originally formal relays of Murray Firth Radio, or they were linked in some way, or we'd help set them up through temporary licenses. All of which are now have their own community stations. Murray Firth Radio! I knew that leaving, I should have done it before. It was a relief in some ways because it was quite stressful. I knew it was going to change. It was going to be hard work for me to do it. And I know it doesn't sound like, but I'm quite a lazy person. So I really didn't fancy that, to be honest. So as with all of these things and throughout, through the other things I've done, it's not the place I miss, it's the people. But I also quite consciously put it behind me. And I was then quite lucky. One door closes, another opens. Actually, I learned that that probably is true. If you're there looking for the glimmer of light coming through the next door. In fact, the hardest thing for me leaving Murray Firth Radio was that people would get in touch with me and would take great delight because they thought I wanted to hear it, that it was all going horribly wrong. I didn't really want to know, and I didn't want to join in that game. The MD who did take over with me, it doesn't really matter, but Gary Robinson took over for a while. And he was kind of like me as a young man. So that was fine. I knew he was going to do things differently. It needed it. I mean, I knew that. And he let me into the place. I still helped out with the charity trust. They let me run I think it was a relief that I would help come in and run Mastermind, the charity auction weekend. This was an innovation here, and I kind of knew how it worked, and I knew what it needed, and so I was able to do that for a while. And I started telling a presenter what he should do on one of these things. And Gary quite firmly said, just remember what you're here for, which wasn't that. I mean, he was quite right. I was beginning to go back into station manager role. I don't remember it as a problem leaving. I think it was long overdue. They had a surprise party for me and all of that was great. But the waiting for what would come next, I set myself up as a sort of local PR man for a while, which I could do, but I learnt that a PR agency of one doesn't work. You have to be available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So you have to be at least two people. I still did some media training, which I'd always done. And that was portfolio careers. That's what they call them in London. In other words, you do lots of different things. You sit on boards and public bodies and do a bit of consultancy. I decided this was too posh a term for the Highlands, so I call it business crafting. You do what's in season. And you do various things. And if you have to go out and feed the pigs, then you do it. It's the equivalent. And then it was suggested that I apply for the Radio Authority, who needed a Scottish member. And I had never thought of that, but Tony Stoller thought I might be appropriate. So I applied for it and got that. You're on the board. They always come up with lovely titles for these things, a member of the Radio Authority. You're basically a board member of the regulatory body that was looking after the radio industry after the IBA was split up. And at the time, the real task was lots and lots of applications for new licenses. There were stacks of them that came through the post. So that was the biggest job the Radio Authority had. There were, of course, other things, but they were about complaints and also working with government to change regulation, the next phase of change of regulation. And a bit that interested me, which was what the Radio Authority called access radio, but not, was really community radio. They didn't want to call it community radio for many reasons, partly because there was a community radio association which had been lobbying for something of the sort. And for kind of political reasons, it was thought not a good idea to call it community radio. This is something different. It changed once it had been started and we'd run the pilots. But that, of course, interested me because I knew very much. But no, the big job was wading through applications written by some professionals, mostly professionals, paid to do the job, who did a wonderful job. But it was measured by the weight and the number of pages and the gloss of the cover. One I've never forgotten came in metal covers. I kept it, just the covers, not the inside. I can't remember who it was. Why did they think? I suppose they thought it made it stand out. But we weren't fools. These were bright people, and they could read between the covers, literally. And they did. And the Radio Authority staff weren't going to be impressed. In fact, they were probably upset at the amount of money that was spent on these applications and the idea that somehow they would be impressed by the glossy pictures and so on. I think I was impressed with the Radio Authority, partly because it was quite a small agency, a relatively small group of people. I do remember having to think to myself, why do we have regulation? I had to go back to that basic in my head. Am I comfortable with the fact that I'm going to be responsible for these rules? And why do we need it? And I remember actually am not having a lot of trouble with that, because I thought the end user is the listener. In this case, was a radio listener. The radio listener expects somebody to have looked after this, to make sure that what they're getting has actually been, if not vetted, is within a framework they can trust. And that's what I saw my role as, to be effectively the person who understood how that might be done and help them do that. And I think having been the practitioner was quite useful in that regard. I became involved again as a member of the Scottish Advisory Committee for Ofcom, and I was its chair for a while. I think we all felt within the radio business that it was a shame that radio wasn't more separate. If you look at it from the government's point of view, that it was entirely logical to put radio in the same body. There was a lot, if I remember rightly, there was quite a long, fierce rearguard action to try to keep radio out of it. And there was a time when it looked as if it would be a separate body. With hindsight, while that would have been good for the radio industry, it was quite illogical, because in the way this has all turned out, like this, podcasting, this is one thing. This is one set of... The boundaries between them are so blurred, and that's a good thing, that the regulation has to be blurred, has to account for that. The radio, I suppose the concession was, the radio bit, if I remember, was still a fairly separate little silo within Ofcom. And I was also a panel member of the Community Radio Fund panel, which gave a bit of money to help community radio stations. So I got my trips down to London every now and then to sit on the side of the river and look out at the city. That was a handy reminder of what the business is really about, which was making money. There's one little bit of my career that I did get a few chances when I worked at Moray Firth Radio, and this was clearly going okay, and I began to get known too, because I had a habit of speaking up. So I got a few job offers from other places. I took one quite seriously because it was in a part of the country which would have been my wife's sort of home territory, and there was a logic to it. And so I went to speak to, I think we can name him, many people will have already, Ralph Barnard, who ran the fledgling GWR group. And I'd known Ralph for a while, and he clearly thought I was worth having. So he had one of the radio stations within the smallish group at the time that needed somebody to take it by the scruff of the neck and do something with it. And it was in Bristol. Well, my wife comes from Bath, and I knew the area quite well, and it would have been a nice place to live. I just remember what passed for an interview in Ralph's office in Shepton Mallet, in a lovely building, and he'd gone out of the room to go and deal with something. And he had teletext on the screen, and teletext was showing his share price. And I thought, I think I know what this business is about. There were many other reasons, but I use that partly as an excuse. The driver was his share price. He's a radio man through and through, made some great programs, and I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the ultimate driver was the money. And that became true, all the merging and so on that went on after that, between radio stations and merging with each other, buying each other, all the rest of it. And that had not a lot to do with the listener. Sounds pompous, but actually that's the bit that I liked about it. That's the bit that I liked about the business I went into later, which was in Africa and Afghanistan, the health education, using radio. Probably learnt that at BBC Local Radio right at the beginning, which was that radio could do great things in terms of keeping people informed and involved and educated, but not dull. And you could do that. And in Africa, we did that with radio drama and saved many lives. This was about AIDS and HIV and so on. Well, they made radio dramas like soap operas. And I didn't think that actually commercial radio in the UK really cared that much about it. Certainly not nearly as much as their share price. so that wasn't for me. And I suppose I didn't think about it that way at the time, but now I know. The thing that's kept me, that it's been about for me, is about the place and people, not about the medium, if you like. So it happened to be radio. But if you look at some of the things that I've been involved with otherwise, which would be things like the Chamber of Commerce or Rotary, or latterly that I did 10 years as a councillor and as chair of planning and things like that, I was very involved with the creation of our university, the University of the Highlands Islands, unique in its way, like Murray Firth Radio. Nothing else like it, because it's distributed and it's... But that's about the place. That's about the people who live here and what it needs. I don't think of it as pompously as it sounds. It just feels right. That, I think, is... If you're looking at people in radio, actually, that's what presenters have. Anybody dealing with the front line, you have that. Or if you haven't, then you shouldn't have been doing it in the first place. Because you probably think about people in a way that many others don't. You think about them going through their lives and what makes their daily existence worthwhile. What makes them happy as they go to work or come home from work or whatever. What are they going to be thinking about, talking about? You understand that. That's a terrific plus and applicable in so many areas. No, I've been very lucky. Things have kind of happened, and I can't say I enjoyed being a politician all that much, a local politician, but I enjoyed the people that made it work. So the officers, the people who do the real work, who are so heavily criticised all the time, they're committed visionaries, but constrained by democracy. I don't think I should have said that, but I think people will know what I mean. People need to get elected. And that's the bit that makes it all go wrong. We need it, and I accept that, because people then come up with quick, short-term hits, populist-sounding things, and they aren't really actually going to help people's lives tomorrow at all. People don't need to remember me for long. There'll be somebody new along. So, how do I want to be remembered? It doesn't matter to me, because I won't be there. It's like people talk about, arranging their funerals as they would like them. It's got nothing to do with you. You won't be there. They can remember me how they like. If it makes them laugh, if I'm still around somewhere, then that's great. Make them smile.
Thomas Prague. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.